Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indie Radio, we are talking about the intersection of food, drink, and hospitality. We'll hear about the soon-to-open beer garden at the Indianapolis Museum of Art and the plans they have for future art and food programming when we talk with Josh Ratliff, the IMA's Director of Hospitality. We'll also check in with award-winning local bartender and bar owner Joshua Gonzalez of Thunderbird. We'll hear about some recent national attention that Thunderbird has received and find out about plans for a new bartending competition in Indianapolis. And then we'll talk with chef and restaurateur Craig Baker about the rebranding of the former Plow and Anchor restaurant as the Taco Shop and what he sees ahead for the Indies dining scene and why he enjoys competitions and TV. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. The culinary arts is a phrase we've all heard, but are food and drink really a part of the arts? Is there a place for them in, say, a museum? Well, the Indianapolis Museum of Art is answering yes to both questions, and a new exhibit is bringing food and drink right into the middle of a new display. As part of the IMA's Spring Blooms Celebration of Color outdoor display, a new beer garden will open adjacent to the museum's greenhouse and gardens. I sat down with the IMA's Director of Hospitality, Josh Ratliff, to talk about what hospitality means for a museum and how the IMA wants to be a neighbor to the city and invite us all over for a beer in its new beer garden. Tell me a little bit about your position and what Director of Hospitality here means.
So the Director of Hospitality is a position that sets the pace and the feel and the direction of the non-art elements here, like food and beverage, the way we collect data about our guests at the front desk or give them a ticket, or the way we design a map, the way you park, everything from your first impression, around the perimeter. Is it easy? Is the signage friendly? That the full guest experience.
So that's all part of hospitality.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. That seems like a very key thing, but something that could easily be overlooked too.
And when it's done right, it is. I work hard to get hospitality in people's minds, especially my employees. That definition is far away from a dining table as possible, because that experience at the dining table, it has like a fancy idea around it, or this wash of being elite. And I think that true hospitality, the vast majority of hospitality, is actually about high touch and about thoughtfulness, remembering names, and then kind of, I come from the empathetic hospitality, not the abundance hospitality school. So Danny Meyer, the first four things that happen to you in your life, an embrace, eye contact, they say your name, and you get a little bit of food. And everyone is trying to go back to that moment whenever they go out to eat or they go to a hotel or things like that. So making eye contact, remembering people's names, giving them a little bit of food, and, a handshake, if not a hug, I don't know. But
so that makes a difference in the overall experience.
Yeah, I think especially because from our exhaustive marketing research that we have been doing over the past 2 years, what we hear over and over and over in comment cards and video interviews is that museums are nice, and that I've been meaning to go back or that it's cold, that it's boring, that it's old. And I think that to combat that, hospitality needs to take a be more of a part of how to solve that problem for the museum.
So how do you do that? What kind of things are you considering, thinking of, implementing that would do that?
Well, first we have to have, we have to keep doing what we're doing well. The guest services department is here, you know, has had a difficult time with general admission, not their capability to be able to implement ticketing, but it's, you know, a lot of people are confused about why it happened, and they kind of ask a lot of those questions in a variety of emotional states to that frontline staff.
I mean, the question of why are you charging admission now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I think dealing with being able to keep up the positive outlook that this every complaint or question is an opportunity. And so I think we've got to keep doing that well. Our guest services team has done really well responding to that and being positive. And what we haven't done before are food and beverage style programming. So like I said, with, you know, making the museum more accessible, the first thing I thought of was, you know, we need to do something like we're a neighbor to the city. And what do you do with a neighbor? You have them over for a beer on your back porch. And so, you know, the greenhouse is kind of out there on in our yard, and it's kind of like a back porch. And so the beer garden was kind of born out of that, saying like, come over for a beer and just say hi, or a brewed beverage of some sort, coffee, tea, beer, or whatnot. So
you have a beer garden now that is attached to the or near the greenhouse or a part of the greenhouse. Tell me how it works.
So the beer garden is, first and foremost, is a part of the garden experience. So everything about how do you get into it or out to it or when's it open, it's a proponent of this new loop around our gardens or pathway. And the beer garden is set, you know, 6-7 minute walk, depending on how fast you need a beer out there on the campus. And it's right, it's like the front porch of the greenhouse. A lot of members and longtime IMA goers are going to know it as the former, like, shade area where all the plants were. And when we were looking for locations to do a food and beverage operation, that shade that all the comes from the pergola slats, that I was like, this is great to stand under and be under. And so we took the existing cedar and kind of took it apart and put it back together to make tables that are fixed like a beer garden. And really that pergola kind of solidified the beer garden as the right path to go down. So, the repurposed part of the greenhouse is there. And,
So people walk up and they can actually order a beer or wine, right?
Right, yeah. So the outdoor experience, the taps, everything that you're, you know, coming to see, or a snack, or big soft tear and share pretzel, can be experienced there at the beer garden. It's like a counter service, like a lot of models I'm seeing in like Louisville, where you get in line, you can order everything, it's delivered to your table, and then if you want something else, you just get back in line. That helps. That helps us monitor the legal side, which is a whole new thing for me, coming from a corporate area where it's all very tight controls on all the hospitality. Here, it's, you know, we're open to the public, and so the big learning curve there was how do we design it so it's all ages, because that's really important to me, but also be intuitive and easy to use for the guest and legal. So the counter service works. and there are four taps. One is a root beer from Triton. There's a wine on tap, which is, I think, a great thing. Even as like a snob about wine, I really think that keg wine helps solve a problem. And it gets, a lot of people say like, what's on tap when they sit down at restaurants now. And I love being able to say a wine in that list, because I think wine has a, not so dissimilar from a museum, wine has this fancy writing, and it's in a bottle, and there's a ritual, and there's a cork, and there's
so being on tap makes it more accessible.
Yeah. Hopefully we'll see if people go for it. It's a dry Riesling from upstate New York, and then you have a custom brew from Sun King, which is
tell me about that. It has a special name, right? Brewed just for you guys.
Yeah. Among the Leaves is an ale. So like it's a part. They're using their native yeast program. So they're pulling and cultivating yeasts like Brettanomyces and some other yeasts that were just that are just naturally in Indiana air floating around. And so it's finishing fermentation, I think, today. And and it'll be available only here. You can taste it at their tap rooms to get a sample. And then the final one is, you know, it's a beer garden. I wanted to tip my cap to Germany. So we got a traditional Pilsner from Warsteiner.
And like you said, the pretzels, right?
Yeah. So these are from Pat's Philly Pretzels. He's been making pretzels here for a long time, and he's doing a custom pretzel for us. It's giant tear and share. Like, I would challenge, I'm a big eater, but I would challenge anybody to finish this by themselves.
We've been talking with Josh Ratliff, Director of Hospitality at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. Stay with us for more from Josh about the museum's new beer garden here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. A beer garden might sound like a surprising addition to an art museum, but when you walk up to the new beer garden at the Indianapolis Museum of Art, it seems like a natural, like it's always been there. Situated under a pergola by the greenhouse amid the IMA's gardens and created with reclaimed materials, the new beer garden really does fit right in. Visitors will be able to buy a beer, a glass of wine, coffee, tea, even locally made root beer for the kids, and hang out, listen to music, and take their drink with them as they walk around the gardens and enjoy the hospitality of the museum's outdoor areas. To take a look at the new space, I walked over to the greenhouse with the IMA's Director of Hospitality, Josh Ratliff, and as we walked through the greenhouse, he explained just what people will experience when the beer garden opens March 31st. So here we are in the greenhouse at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. Tell me about the greenhouse experience as it relates to the beer garden.
So the greenhouse is immediately adjacent to and kind of surrounding the beer garden. So initially we were calling this the garden beer garden because it's so full of floriculture and experts working with it. So, you know, the greenhouse is, you know, steps away from where you would order and have your beer, and you're more than welcome to stroll around and look at exotic cactuses or orchids, and
so people can come right in with it with their beer.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, that's very cool. Now, what are they going to see when they walk up to the beer garden? Because it's coming together. I mean, it's almost ready, right?
They'll see it full of paying customers. I don't know about that just yet, but they'll hear some music. We have a big playlist curated by DJ Kyle Long, and then, you know, they'll see a friendly face. They'll see a menu, a tiny but mighty menu, and they'll see places to sit, places to stand, places to walk around with a beer. And, you know, I think they'll see something they've never seen before, which is an outdoor beer garden for all ages, covered in curated floriculture.
So, And because it is all ages and it's indoor, outdoor, and you don't have to worry about it being whether you can get a seat or not, because you can take your beer and walk around, right, out into the garden.
Absolutely. So anywhere on our upper campus gardens is, you know, kind of part of the Spring Blooms experience, and we welcome you to, you know, to have that. So the one note is you can't enter the other historic properties of the museum with your beer, but yeah.
Well, yeah, but you can wander around and kind of soak up the outdoors with your wine or beer or your root beer from the beer garden. Now, tell me a little bit more about the specifics of the operation hours and that sort of thing.
Okay, so the most important thing to know is that we will be open evenings. So Thursday night, Friday night, and Saturday night, we will be open, which we haven't tried in a long time.
But this is after museum hours.
Correct. Yeah, so after you get your art fix, at 5, we'll stay open on the garden level, which includes the ground floor, the museum, and everything outdoors all the way up until 9. So the beer garden specifically is oriented towards an audience for Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
So now tell me how the beer garden and some of your hospitality initiatives fit in with exhibitions and what's coming and what you're doing.
So the Spring Blooms exhibition is a 2-month long experiment for us to really curate the entire upper campus or the entire IMA Gardens as a gallery. So what I am doing with the beer garden is really just to enhance that experience. If you want to pause and reflect with a cup of tea or a glass of wine on your trip around the gardens, or you want to meet some friends at 5 or 6 and just be out in it while you have a beer, it's very flexible. Spring Blooms is unlike any other exhibition in that we encourage you to you know, get out and walk around and be, you know, you don't have to be like silent and whispering in some big echoey white room. It's you bring your stroller, and well, if it has a cup holder, you can put a beer in it, and yeah.
So you're all set. Well, now tell me how this kind of fits in with your bigger vision for hospitality and food here at the IMA.
Well, I think there's a lot of key questions that a museum is trying to answer, or global conversations that we're trying to be a part of. And what does a museum do with food and food culture? How do you preserve and animate and interpret culinary art? Because as you said, it's ephemeral and it's here and gone. But I think one answer is you can make a connection with people by sharing, you know, a place like this with them. And then you can talk about maybe something that they didn't know, or that they wouldn't have come here to see a painting, but they would come here for a beer. You know, really just helping the IMA's bigger mission with food and beverage by saying, hey, like, come out, see all of our art, and have a beer with us or have a cup of coffee with us while you're here. And I think that's what I want to do, is make an on-ramp to everything at the museum. And I think that Hoosiers are proud to be a beer state. They're proud to be part of the Midwest, frugal, mild-tempered people that might not necessarily be craving the newest contemporary art all the time. And I think that simple things like sharing a beer together or a walk in a beautiful park, those are experiences that people should be doing at an art museum.
Now, how does that translate to experiences that are a little bit more out there? Does food and wine sort of help you, you know, ease into those kinds of experiences as well?
Yes, I think hospitality in general is kind of under-conceptualized, and I think that treating people in a really hospitable way with food and beverage and great service and great empathy shouldn't have to be Michelin star they can be, they can just, it could be any form of hospitality. And I think that's what we can be the best at here at the IMA, is authentic experiences with a high touch, but not necessarily a high cost.
We've been talking with Josh Ratliff, Director of Hospitality at the Indianapolis Museum of Art. For more information on the museum's Spring Blooms display and its new beer garden, go to imamuseum.org/springblooms2017. It's always great when the National Food and Drink Press discover another aspect of what's happening here in Central Indiana. This past week, the website liquor.com posted its Drink Here Now list, and a couple of Indianapolis bars made the list. In the neighborhood bar category, Dorman Street Saloon represents Indy admirably. And in another category, spotlighting innovation, Thunderbird in Fountain Square joined an impressive list of well-regarded cocktail bars around the country. I sat down for coffee with Joshua recently to talk about the national notice, what's happening on the local cocktail scene, and about his plans to bring a speed bartending competition to Indianapolis. In the month of May, of course. So that's very nice to be included in the liquor.com thing. So tell me a little bit about that and how you noticed it.
Yeah, so liquor.com is it's a great website geared toward bar professionals and bar industry professionals. A lot of education on cocktails, techniques. It's also kind of brand driven, so there's like some content that the brands will promote. I'm not sure how many years. I think this is the third year they've done their Drink Here list. This was the first year that was a global list, 263 bars selected by their writers from all over the world. And we were lucky enough to get on that list. So
that's pretty cool. In a list, that included bars around the world, the Drink Here kind of places people should go. That's pretty neat.
Yeah, it was really cool. And, they had different categories that the bars were listed in, like neighborhood bars. Dorman Street made the list, which was awesome. Dorman's a great example of the sort of perfect neighborhood bar. And we were in the team players category, which is kind of the guys that are innovators, kind of setting the standard in different markets. And again, it was pretty, I saw the list of bars and I was like, I'm not sure I belong in this company.
It was great company, but you do belong in there. So what is that like to be, among that sort of company and to be considered that sort of proprietor, owner, bartender, that kind of thing?
It's super cool because the cool part is I know most of those people that own those bars or work at those bars. So it's fun to see those lists and know that your friends are having success and in Chicago, New York, or San Francisco, Denver, wherever those bars might be located. And to be there also is very, there's a level of validation, I guess, that comes with that, where you feel like, okay, we've been doing this now for, 3 years, and somebody noticed that we're kind of operating on a different level. And that's cool. That's fun.
So how would you describe the program at Thunderbird?
It's foundational bartending driven. I mean, and that's the key for how we operate. It's understanding your flavors, understanding balance, understanding the importance of acidity in cocktails, understanding the importance of sugar in cocktails. It's not a wheely-neely process that we have. Everything is very well thought out, and the flavors that we pair together are, it's not a trial and error. It's kind of like there's a lot of study that goes into the before a drink actually gets R&D'd and building of layering flavors. But again, it's really all coming back to understanding how to make a really good classic and then how to slightly alter that classic to make a new drink.
So have you found that there's good response from your clientele with that sort of focus?
Yeah, and I think, too, the thing that separates us from other bars is just our playfulness. We keep it very light. We keep the cocktail names, the concepts behind them, they're all very light. They're very fun. They're very accessible. I think that also makes it easier for people coming in that aren't necessarily familiar with the style of drinks that we do to, see a vessel that is, honey bear, a cocktail served in a honey bear, or a cocktail served in a tin can, or a cocktail that's on fire, right? So it's disarming, and it lets people say, oh, we're in a bar that's having fun, so we can have fun too.
So now tell me a little bit about some of those cocktails. You know, like the one in the honey bear, because people see the honey bears up there.
Yeah. So again, a lot of that is coming from, you know, I'm lucky that we've been able to travel a lot, and my bartenders travel a lot, and we see what other markets are doing, or see something creative that's been doing that's happening at another bar, and how can we incorporate that in a way that makes sense for us. So, you know, the honey bear was a thing that Devin Boyle saw about a year ago at an event. And really liked that. Thought it was a cool presentation. So we, you know, we're like, hey, how can we make that work? And still, you know, a year later, people asking, can I get the honey bear drink? So it becomes a little bit of a bane too. But you know, I think we still have a couple just of honey bears sitting around, just so we can serve them in the vessel when someone calls for it.
Well, now you have a lot of things happening. You're very involved in the greater cocktail community. And I know that you've done some special events, you know, that involves cocktails and that sort of thing and fundraisers. Tell me a little bit about what you've been doing and what you've got coming up.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the goals that I had as we were going into 2017 was to really engage the community. Obviously, you know, a very tumultuous political climate at the end of the year, and I think people are coming out of that feeling very uncertain about, you know, the future of our country, and that made me want to sort of get engaged and really involve the bar community in a way that allows us to give back to our neighborhood, to give back to our city. So we hosted an event back in December, the Female AF Party, and that was a big success. We raised about $2,000 for the Julian Center, female-focused event. You know, it was a great party, and I was blown away at the turnout. And I wanted to maintain that momentum and do something at a larger scale. So we just put together the Pedal to the Metal Speed Challenge that'll take place May 21st at the White Rabbit. We wanted it to coincide with the month of May for all the race events. So I don't think we've ever had a speed challenge in Indy before. So I'm kind of taking the format for an old speed event called Rematch that was a global event, and Speed Rack, which is another speed challenge, kind of combining them together to make an event where bartenders have to make 6 to 8 drinks in under about 4 minutes and advance in a tournament style bracket to crown the champion for the night. And the proceeds for that are going to the Fountain Square Immigrant Welcome Center.
Now that's very fun. You know, it's a good time of year for something fun like that. You know, May is great. Good cause and a fun competition. So we really haven't had a speed competition here.
Never had a speed competition. And, you know, bartenders always love to pride themselves on how fast they can get drinks out. So I'm really excited about this one. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's 80s metal themed. So all the contestants are going to have to dress up. They're going to have to pick theme music, entrance music. We've got a DJ that'll be playing 80s metal the whole night. It should be a really, really fun event. We're hoping to at least get about 100 people to show up and support the cause. And again, when you're watching those sort of two bartenders on stage battle it out, all making the same drinks at the same time, you know, it's fun. It makes for a fun event. But I'd like to see more events like this where we're bringing in different bars, different style of bartenders. It doesn't have to be the fancy craft stuff because there's great bartenders that are doing high volume. You know, like I said, at the Brass Ring every Friday night is insane. I don't know how those girls do it. And then also what I would like to see, not necessarily from just bars and cocktails in general, but from the industry as a whole, the food and beverage industry, is a focus back on the community. You know, when we think about hospitality and what that means, that's, you know, providing a service to a stranger, right? You know, whether it's a bed to sleep in, a meal, a hot meal on a cold night, that whole concept of the guest being sort of sacred, right? And I think a lot of times we forget as owners and as the sort of the cult of the celebrity chef has grown and the star tender, we've forgotten that. And I think it's really, really important that as we grow our businesses and as we grow the food community, that we're not leaving people behind. So how can we engage those people? How can we get them access to food? How can we get them access to education on basic kitchen skills? Those are things that I'm looking to sort of think about as I move forward in 2017. I've been talking to some people at the YMCA, been talking to some people at the there's a school, a magnet school in the neighborhood, about how we can volunteer some of our time and engage kids, talking to them about the importance of, you know, nutrition, and but also how to get access to that, because unfortunately a lot of the kids that are in this neighborhood don't have access to quality fruit to food. So those are the things that I've been thinking about, and that would be my challenge to anybody out there growing their businesses and opening new restaurants. Is it's great, that's all fine and wonderful, and I'm glad that everybody's been successful, but let's think about how we can give back to the communities that have made us successful, and then not forget about those people that that struggle.
We've been talking with Thunderbird owner Joshua Gonzalez. For more information on the Fountain Square Bar, go to thunderbirdindy.com or look for it on Facebook. We've heard a lot lately about the fast-growing and fast-changing Indianapolis dining scene right now. High-profile restaurants have closed, while others have just shuttered temporarily to change focus and rebrand. One such change is Plow and Anchor, an upscale restaurant that opened 3 years ago at Pennsylvania and 9th Streets in downtown Indianapolis. Chef owner Craig Baker has opted to rebrand that restaurant space and reopen as a more casual taco shop. In fact, that's the name. The taco shop will open soon with a street food-inspired menu, but the space will also be used for special events. Craig tells us about the shift from Plow and Anchor to the taco shop, about the kind of special dining events that it will be hosting, and some of the challenges facing the local restaurant community. First of all, we should probably talk about what's up with the Plow and Anchor space.
So it's going to be the taco shop. It's pretty clear what that is. We're going to make 400 tortillas a day, and when we sell out, we sell out. We're going to integrate in, like, tamales at some point, I think Thursdays. Kind of just want to have a lot of fun with it. It's like a fun space. We're going to, yeah.
So tell me how different that is from Plow and Anchor, just in case people aren't aware of, you know, what you were doing there and how it's changed and what you're going to be doing now.
So Plow was kind of like a, I'll call it quasi-fine dining, if you will. I mean, it wasn't that formal, but it was pretty formal. This will be the exact opposite. Like, this is more like, come in, get, you know, $2.50, $3 tacos, homemade, you know, everything's going to be house-made, from tortillas to the chips to guac, salsa, everything. We're going to have a turkey pozole, so it's a little healthier version, a couple salads. We will have churros, I think. So that's not healthy, but it's really kind of focusing on that gluten-free options because it's masa. And then we'll have some vegan stuff, so we'll be able to hit a lot of different things, kind of meet some dietary needs, but really keep it very casual and very, like, and just good, like simple, good street food.
So why the change?
So we ran into some parking issues with construction, and it was a destination restaurant. And so basically I was like, let's focus on the neighborhood and get the people that are living in the neighborhood to be able to come. We were doing a very steady lunch business. I think that's there, that crowd is there. And then we're going to add a three-way, I think. So we'll be able to do some margaritas and that kind of stuff. And I mean, the space is just there to have fun with. It's going to be like for people to come in and have a very casual environment to slam some tacos and have a couple beers and, you know, just kind of relax after work as long as we don't sell out. But we'll have, like, especially after we have a liquor license, we'll have, like, some things to keep. And then at night, the whole point is that we'll be able to host events. And we're letting other chefs come and host events there, whether it be Chef's Night Off type events or other chefs just trying to do some new things for whatever they, you know, they can't do in their own restaurants.
Now, why is that important to the community? You know, have people being able to do interesting things like that that are sort of different than what they might do at a regular restaurant?
Well, one, it's going to help push the food scene. So it's difficult to have an idea and then take it to execution when you're in a restaurant and you have to produce it for like 100 people. For us, you know, if you have a dinner, Alan Sternberg from Cerulean is doing one there this Sunday, and he'll be able to do things that he can't do maybe for service until he executes it a few times and practice it, you know? So he has practice on a smaller scale, and then we're able to upscale it to implement it into the restaurant. And I think that having the kitchen there is going to give people the ability to do more interesting cuisine, to also see, like, not, I don't mean like high end, like I'm saying like maybe like new flavor profiles, new ethnic things, to see if it'll, what a smaller group of people will do, almost as a test market. And we can sell those tickets for fairly inexpensively. The space is free to the chefs, and then any beer and wine that they sell, then we retain to the house. It's a really, it's not a new concept, but it's new to Indianapolis.
Well, I think it's very cool that it allows people to try some of those things, you know, to do a one-off dinner that they probably couldn't do anywhere else.
Yeah, and I like Omar Guzman, who's doing events, and I'm hoping that he'll take advantage of this in the future. He's reached out to me a couple of times. It just hasn't worked out, but as a perfect example, who wants to focus on true Mexican cuisine, and maybe, you know, he can't do that there, but he could certainly do it, you know, at Plow or Taco Shop, or it's going to take me a while to get over that, but yeah, I mean, that will, it'll get shortened to the shop is like what'll happen, but yeah, I mean, those are the kind of things I think also, I mean, it builds camaraderie with the chefs, and it, and in this culture right now, especially the environment, I should say, everyone's fighting over employees because we have so many new restaurants opening and everything. I think getting people to interact more will help maintain a more healthy environment for the food scene in the long run.
Well, now talk a little bit about the current environment that we see, because, you know, there is an employee shortage. There's a, you know, hard to get people. You know, there's been a lot of challenges with the market. We've seen a lot of restaurants, a goodly number of restaurants, close or rebrand, you know, like you're doing with the Plow space. So talk a little bit about your, you know, what you've seen as far as the current restaurant climate.
So I have this theory that there's a large group of Indianapolis diners who want to, their dining habits have become more event driven. And it doesn't help that, I mean, there's a gala every day, there's a wine dinner every day. I mean, you can name it, there's something going on that you can do food related now. But so I feel like a lot of the rebranding that's going on is because we have ADD as a city, and so if you're not like the new thing, then you quickly become the old thing. And a lot of that isn't because that the restaurants aren't good, it's just that there's so many new restaurants that people don't have the dining dollars to eat and continue to support these restaurants. And it's the same in New York, or I mean Chicago, it's not new. I think the restaurant cycle in New York's 3 years. So that seems to be the thing here. Like, we have to rebrand and continue growing and pushing the limits.
I have heard that it's easier to close and rebrand than to keep that momentum going, you know, beyond 4, 5, 6 years.
Yeah, and not only that, but the staff, because there's so much opportunity with new restaurants, the staff has ADD. And so they want to learn and try new foods and cuisines. And so you have a lot of turnover in the mid-market with people who are, you know, not quite sous chef level, who want to continue to grow. And so they're moving around quickly, and they'll do it for a quarter. You know, I mean, it's not like about money. I mean, it's about like they want to grow, and it's good to see the younger generation like that.
It just makes it very challenging for an employer.
Right. And yeah, and with a shortage anyway, it's hard to get retention. And then the people a lot of times that you're finding are placeholders instead of, it wasn't like Indianapolis was a, you know, we had a plethora of competent and qualified cooks to begin with, or not even that. I mean, now it's servers, managers, which, you know, you could say arguably that there was a more casual approach as a country to cuisine. And it happened in the larger cities first, in big dining destinations like Portland, San Francisco, you know, whatnot. I would argue that that was a product of what we're going through right now, because I lived through this already in Portland.
So the cook shortage that we hear so much about, that's real, and that's here too, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's definitely real. I mean, immigration policy has caused there been a lot of people who've left, and that's not just a recent thing. I mean, after the economic crash in 2007, basically people started leaving. So that put us on a downside. The culinary schools can't turn people out quick enough for as many restaurants are opening up. And then you have Chicago, Cincinnati, and Pittsburgh poaching our cooks. So it leaves us in a precarious position. It's interesting for sure.
We've been talking with chef and restaurateur Craig Baker of the local Bent Rail and the soon-to-open taco shop. We'll be right back with more from Craig here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Culinary competitions seem to have become a permanent fixture on the local entertainment scene these days. Throwdowns, challenges, and other competitions have become spectator sports for a generation that's grown up watching food TV. But what are those competitions like? I sat down recently with Indianapolis chef and restaurateur Craig Baker, an admitted adrenaline junkie who loves the fun of food competitions. Craig tells us about competing, emceeing, being on TV, and why he loves it all, despite a few high-profile pitfalls, all captured by the cameras, of course. So let's talk a little bit about some of your projects and what you've done. You do a lot of competing, actually. You've competed in a variety of competitions, food competitions, you know. So tell me a little bit about that and why you do it.
I love it. Probably because I'm an adrenaline junkie. It's just fun. And I've been fortunate enough to do some national ones. So I've got to meet chefs from all over the country. And, you know, it's rough a lot of times when you're doing them. But then at the end, we all kind of get to hang out. And you know, social media is a great thing for a lot of people. But for us, we work all the time. And so that, even though we may not see each other for 6 months, that friendship stays because we're always communicating via, you know, Facebook or whatever, Twitter, you know, Instagram. So it's really weird. Like, I'll post something on Instagram and then like the first five people to respond like are all like people that live in New Mexico. Cause
people that you've met through other events.
Yeah. Through other events. And, you know, it's the competition part maybe be a little bit hokey for some people, but you know, for me, it's not really about that. It's always been about like the camaraderie that comes out of it. And I don't mind pushing myself for an hour or, you know, whatever it may be to have the fun and kind of get into it. And I'll drive to Chicago for a culinary competition. I have no problem with that.
So what are some of the competitions that you've done?
So I've done World Foods four times, and sixth is the best I've placed. 16th is the worst. I just can't seem to do any better than that. But this year I'm really excited because, Culinary Fight Club, which is run by RJ, is a qualifier for Worlds. So we're trying to put together Team Indiana, and, we have some big sponsors that are already involved, Red Gold and Maple Leaf. And, so I'm hoping to kind of build like a team of nine. I think there's gonna be nine of us who are going to qualify, and then all of us go down. And we'll have our own support network. And, you know, I've done it, like I said, a bunch. So I can help everybody and kind of give them the run of it. And I'm hoping we can win some stuff. So,
well, now that'd be very fun. You know, beyond the you know, the awareness that comes, you know, the higher profile awareness that comes from winning something like that. It would probably be a lot of fun, you know, and something that would just be, you know, a cool thing to do with a group of local chefs.
Yeah, and it's an event, so they pay for, like, they sponsor for a lot of stuff. So there's like all these parties and stuff that go along with it, and you can get caught up in that. My first year was in Vegas, and I was like, woohoo, we're in Vegas, you know, and I kind of got caught up in that, and I was like, okay, I'm going home at 16th, but I mean, there's 450 competitors, and each competitor has at least one sous chef. Barbecue brings, because it's a KCBS or whatever, that they win $50,000 for that. And then they go on to the final table and they can win $100,000. So, like, if I win the seafood bracket, I only get 10 grand going up, but I still get to compete for the 100 grand. But it's fun. And you have, you know, 1,500 people who are all like chefs, or some of them are home cooks, you know, who qualify in for like winning, yeah, I don't know.
Some recipe contest?
Yeah, or like the. Yeah, like the who won the Pillsbury or whatever, they won $1 million or something, and she's there, like, and it's a kind of like a food forum for the Food Network, you know, they find people there. And
so now tell me a little bit about that, about you know, when things are filmed and when it's like, because they've been, done programs on this and you've been a part of those. Yeah. So do you like the being on camera stuff?
Yeah, like I love it. I really do. It's fun for me. And last year, the best story, this is like the best thing that came out of it. I was working with George Triquette. He was my sous chef last year. And we had a fire in the grill. Like, we were doing burger, and we put andouille on top of our burgers. And it just started to melt instantly. So it was like this huge grease fire. And I like look at him in panic, and I'm like, hand me a beer. And because we had beer, that's what we do. And he hands me his, and it's already open. I'm like, no, like, I can't use yours. You know, he drank out of it, obviously. So by the time he fiddles and gets one, I like dump it in, and like this, we're under a tent in the middle of, like, and so this pillar of smoke, like 4 feet wide, went up to all the way to the ceiling and across, and like filled the whole place up. And I was like, God, you know, and I, expletive, and I turn and look, and there's a camera in my face, and they've been there the whole time, and the cameraman cuts away, right, and he looks at me, he goes, did you plan that? And I was like, yeah, that's exactly, like, I planned that, like, I just lost half of my burgers, you know, like, so we burned half, and we made extra, but we ended up serving halves instead of wholes to the judges.
And but that's a good TV segment, right?
Yeah, but it was unintentional, and I was not happy. I mean, I was really not happy. But, you know, like, when you have an hour and you have to do everything from scratch there, and you get pushed, you know, things get away from you time, and it got away from us a little bit. And then we had never made that burger before. Like, conceptually, in our minds, like, we were like, oh, that'll be great. And until we put that on there, and like, all it just melts like butter, and then instantly it was like fire. So I won't do that next year.
Now, you've mentioned, you know, when for Culinary Fight Club, you know, having the microphone and talking to the people and kind of emceeing something like that. Did you like that?
Yeah, it was fun. I got to RJ and I went to Alabama, and we drove down 10 hours in the car, and well, I did it in 8.5, but we won't get into that. And we got down there, and then it's like the local news. We did 4 news segments from 5:30 till 9:30, and then we had to set up. We did a little bit different format. The chef of the restaurant where it was, he and I actually prepped food. So theirs was savory chocolate was the theme. And so he and I put together a bunch of dishes. I did a duck dish with like a kind of a rift on like a chocolate reduction. And we did a bunch of other stuff, and it was fun. But then I got to work with Jannard Wells, who was he plays second in Next Food Network Star, who was the MC. And then I went around and interviewed the chefs, and And it was a lot of fun to be one, to be on the other side of that microphone, because normally I'm the one like they're trying to mess with. And two, you know, to like kind of interact with the chefs on a level that I've never had that opportunity. So it was a lot of fun. We had a good time.
So is that something you'd like to do more of?
Yeah, I'd love to do more of that. I'd like to host Indie Style. Yeah, I said it.
Well, no, that's very fun. So I'm on there talking a lot, so I think that'd be very fun. So you'd be a host on Indie Style.
You heard that, Tracy. I know you're listening. No, I mean, I think it would be like something like that would be fun, or to do more like food coverage, maybe, if I could figure out how to do that. But like, that's the stuff I really like. I enjoy that part of it. I think people are interested, and a lot of times that people that are covering that stuff, they're not getting into the level of, I don't know, like the technical level that I think a lot of people would appreciate. And so to have someone on like that way dealing with some of that stuff might be kind of fun. And I definitely enjoy it more than judging.
We've been talking with chef and restaurateur Craig Baker of the local Bent Rail and the soon-to-open taco shop. For more on Craig, look for him on Facebook and Instagram. Jolene Katzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, and D Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning into our show this week, spotlighting food, drink, and hospitality. And thanks also to our guests, Indianapolis Museum of Art Director of Hospitality, Josh Ratliff, Thunderbird owner, Joshua Gonzalez, and chef and restaurateur Craig Baker of the local Bent Rail and the soon-to-open taco shop. And thanks also to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, and D Radio. Eat, Drink, Indie Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat, drink, Indie.